This podcast exists because of the paid members at DecodingTV.com. I don't know if you're aware, but A Cast of Kings is part of a podcast network called Decoding TV. And it's a podcast network run by me, David Chen. I'm hosting all the podcasts right now. Maybe later on, there's going to be other people hosting podcasts. It's going to be a lot of fun. I hope you'll follow us along with this journey. But you can find more episodes of Decoding TV podcasts at podcast.decodingtv.com and sign up to be a paid member at Decoding TV to get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and exclusive bonuses we'll make just for you. Thanks to everyone at DecodingTV.com who makes this podcast possible.
The emblems of the Seven serve only to guide us on an uncertain path, to remind us of a higher authority.
And on the morrow, which authority will sit in judgment of my son's claim on his own inheritance?
That would be mine. And the Hand's. But be assured, the Father is just and commands me to forget the accusations you have held in this room today.
A lot of per my email energy in the Allison clip just now. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial recap podcast about the HBO original series House of the Dragon. I'm David Chen. I've never read Fire and Blood, the book on which House of the Dragon is based.
And I'm Kim Renfro, and I have read Fire and Blood, the book upon which House of the Dragon is based.
Every week on A Cast of Kings, we recap, review, spoil each week's episode of House of the Dragon. This week, we'll be discussing Season 1, Episode 8, The Lord of the Tides. You can find more episodes of this podcast at acastofkings.com. Email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Find us on TikTok, Twitter, YouTube, at acastofkings, where we have a slowly growing audience of folks watching this on YouTube these days. So that's very exciting. Speaking of our audience, on last week's episode of the podcast, I may have vaguely hinted that I was catching some flack for my criticism. I was getting criticized for my critiques of House of the Dragon. And I said, hey, you know, if you're enjoying the podcast, do write in. Well, we received hundreds of emails this week from people saying they actually like the show. So that's great to hear. Thanks to everyone for writing in with those emails at acastofkings@gmail.com. We really appreciate it. So just wanted to say a quick thank you for that. And the podcast will continue to be what the podcast is, and I have received enough affirmation that we should continue our current approach, that's what we'll be doing for the remainder three episodes of this podcast.
Yes. Thank you for the validation and encouragement, everyone. It's excellent.
Indeed. It's extremely appreciated. And I'll just say quickly also that, like, this is a dynamic I found that's really weird, unfortunate, but basically, like, you know, the stuff that you often consume for a really long time, you don't often like reach out and tell the person who you're listening to or watching that you like their work. Cause you know, I think a lot of people assume like just the view is enough or just the listen is enough. But oftentimes what ends up happening then is only the malcontents write it.
Mm-hmm.
and it creates like a very skewed perspective of who's actually watching or listening. So this is just my affirmation. I'm not fishing for more emails. I'm just saying, like, in general, yeah. I'm saying in general, like, if you like something, reach out to the person and tell them you like it. I practice this in my life all the time. Like, I'm tweeting at people, hey, randomly, I listened to this person's album on Spotify. I'm just like, you know what? I'm enjoying this album. I just tweet at them, hey, love the album. They have no idea who the heck I am. It's a completely random note, but I still think it is worth it. So
yeah,
putting aside Cast of Kings, if you're enjoying work out there and you like what people are doing, reach out, tweet at them, write them, tell them you like it. Because they're probably not getting a ton of that, depending on who they are. You know, if
that's
they're Tom
true.
Cruise, maybe they are. But
no, it's true. I still remember the first time that you reached out to me to tell me that you liked an article I wrote.
Oh,
like, that really sticks in people's
minds. I don't even remember that.
See,
but yeah, there you go. Exactly. See, so Kim, you know, I practice what I preach.
You do, and it's very appreciated. It was a Westworld thing.
Nice.
Yeah.
So speaking of what's going to happen over the course of the next few episodes, I think there have been a couple questions about what's going to happen with A Cast of Kings after House of the Dragon is over. Kim and I have talked. There have been multiple intense negotiations, but I do want to let people know what is going to happen with this podcast feed at current, at present plan, which could change. At present, the plan is for the podcast to kind of go dormant for the most part in the off season until the next episode, next season of House of the Dragon. Mm-hmm. There will be occasional updates. So if there's like a big update that drops, or if the Jon Snow show goes into production or is airing before the next House of the Dragon, like, we'll probably pop on here and let you know what the plan is. And any other kind of major Game of Thrones news, we'll kind of try to get together a bonus episode. So be sure to keep subscribed to this feed. But for the most part, at this point, the plan is for it to kind of go quiet until the next season of House of the Dragon. Mm-hmm. When will the next season of House of the Dragon happen? Good question. Kim, you have a guess out there, right? Like, what's your guess as to season two of House of the Dragon air date?
I think soonest would be spring 2024. So about a year and a half out would be like the earliest. Maybe they're going to continue this pattern of fall premiering. Game of Thrones kind of like stuck to the same, like they were always putting out new seasons in spring, and then it switched at some point when production started taking longer. So I think it just depends on what the production schedule is like, but we know that they're already working on season two. Yeah.
So anyway, want people to know what the plan is. It's probably going to be at least 18 months until the next season of House of the Dragon. Possibly as much as 2 years, maybe even more. Who knows? But keep it tuned in to the Cast of Kings podcast, and we will provide updates in the future when possible. There's also a possibility that, you know, anything is also possible on the podcast feed. Things could happen where we decide to cover other shows on this podcast feed with other permutations of hosts. One of us could win the lottery and we decide, hey, we're not covering House of the Dragon next season. Like, anything's possible. So if you want to learn the fate of Cast Kings, be sure to keep subscribed and we will update you. Okay. That is it in terms of the pre-show stuff, the pre-recap stuff. Let's dive into season one, episode 8 of House of the Dragon, The Lord of the Tides. This episode was written by Eileen Shim and directed by Geeta Vasant Patel. These are like relatively new names in the Game of Thrones universe, as far as I can tell, right, Kim?
Yeah, first time we've had a credit for both of these women in the show. And as I did some research to confirm this, this is certainly the first time across all the Westeros shows, so Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, that two women have been the main credits on the episode, not to mention two women of color. So I think it's pretty awesome that we're already seeing a sort of shift in the pattern of which types of directors and writers are getting to take the lead on this story.
Indeed, indeed. Let's talk about overall thoughts on season one, episode 8. What did you think of the episode, Kim?
I loved it. As just continuing my pattern here. I loved like the intimacy of this episode combined with a lot of those big sort of awe-inspiring shots, like the whole opening at Dragonstone, or like the second scene at Dragonstone with Daemon finally go, like we get to see dragon eggs like in their natural nesting habitat for the first time. Like so many cool little like lore tidbits sprinkled in with a lot of, I think, really, really great character moments for our main cast of characters. What'd you think?
I really liked the episode, Kim. I thought it was a pretty great episode. Patty Considine, incredible this episode, and really positioned as the protagonist of this episode, I think, in a way that visually is super interesting, just like the way they did the makeup effects, visual effects, special effects. It all feels really authentic and impressive. And of course, I have some qualms, but overall, I would say great episode of the show. I mean, what's been great about this show, House of the Dragon, is, again, like the strengths that I point to from this season are each episode feels like a self-contained story. It's very episodic to me, and I think this episode does a good job of kind of delivering on that idea. But also, like, just some great water cooler moments. Now, moments you have to discuss with other people. Now, some of those moments may be good, some of them may be bad. We'll get to them as we talk about this episode. But overall, I thought it was great. I feel like watching the show, talking about it, is like a good use of my time. It's like a lot to dig into, and this episode continues that trend. So
yeah, certainly, like not perfect by any means, but like I think that what they've been doing so far in terms of like balancing those sort of intimate personal character moments with like the bigger spectacle, I think has they've struck a really good balance, I think, between those two things with this series so far.
I think so. Let's dive into what happens this episode. Kim, in this episode, there's been a massive time jump, and Rhaenyra has had two children off screen and is expecting another one. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. Wait, sorry, Kim. I got my notes. This was actually my notes for episode 6. I apologize. I was looking at the wrong thing. That's actually my notes for episode 6. I'm sorry. No,
same, but different, but still same.
But no, it does seem as though a massive time jump has occurred.
Uh-huh.
Rhaenyra has had two children off screen, and she is pregnant in this episode. I don't think she's pregnant in episode 6. So I did kind of stretch my.
She's just actively giving birth.
Yes, she's actively giving birth. 6. Exactly right.
Very recently pregnant.
Yes, extremely recently.
Extremely minutes ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, yeah. So technically what I said was correct. Uh-huh. Anyway, we start with Rhaenys at Driftmark. And this is one time where the show actually gives you a marker right at the beginning of how much time has passed. So thank you very much, show. They basically we find out that 6 years have passed. Since we last saw Lord Corlys, who went off and go fighting, right, with the Triarchy and the Stepstones and so on. Now, I was still a little bit confused initially because it was 6 years since Corlys left, but we didn't see him leave last episode. So I was like,
right.
How long actually has it been? Has it been like 8 years, 10 years? But I think you're meant to understand that it's been roughly 6 years.
Yeah, you're meant to assume that Corlys departed very shortly after the events of last episode, where Laenor died. Died.
So yes. So Corlys is in a bad state. Apparently, his neck has been slashed, and he fell overboard into the sea, and he has a fever, and it's very likely he's going to die on the way back home. That's kind of what Corlys' situation is.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know if he's dead, but they're like, hey, we should prepare for the possibility that he's going to die. Vaemond, who in the show, I believe is Corlys' brother.
Yeah.
But you have said in the book, it's actually Corlys' nephew, right?
Yeah, he's his eldest nephew, according to Fire and Blood. But they've referred to him as like uncle, like Laenor referred to him as uncle earlier in the season and stuff. So I believe that they've sort of simplified that relationship to just be that Vaemond is Corlys's brother and therefore the closest. The point is that he is the closest blood relative to Corlys at this point, who is still alive. If you don't count bastards, which a decent chunk of characters in this show do not like counting bastards. So,
mm-hmm. Well, that's the whole tension of this episode and this scene, right, which is that the idea, as we saw last episode, Corlys's will was that Driftmark pass on to Lucerys, aka Luke, aka Rhaenyra's son,
mm-hmm.
Or Rhaenyra and Laenor's son, right, mm-hmm. ostensibly, but it's not really Laenor's son, it's not Laenor's blood, but it is Rhaenyra's son. Now, yeah. And as Corlys put it last episode, names matter more than blood. History remembers names. Vaemond is not that progressive. Vaemond is more like, actually, history remembers blood. And he thinks that he has a stronger claim to the Driftmark throne than does Lucerys, a.k.a. Luke, a.k.a. Rhaenyra and Laenor's child.
Yes, exactly.
And so that's kind of the argument here in the opening scene of this episode is, can Vaemond be in the line of succession? And Rhaenys is kind of non-committal, but she is fairly clear that, like, hey, Vaemond, by even touching upon this, you're entering dangerous territory.
Right.
Awfully close to being a traitor to the house of Lord Corlys's house. So,
right.
Only other thing I want to mention is obviously Bela's there. We learn later, Bela, who is Daemon and Laena's daughter, right?
Yes, youngest daughter. Mm-hmm.
She's chilling there at Driftmark, and we later find out that she was sent to ward at Driftmark which is basically Rhaenys and their family are taking care of Baela, and it's a kind of way to make sure that Daemon doesn't go rogue and do something wild and upsetting, right? Or Daemon and Rhaenyra don't do something that would damage Driftmark.
Yeah, I'm not, they don't really explain the reasoning behind Baela warding there. Like, I think we've talked about this in previous episodes, but we've seen like the version of ward of like Theon Greyjoy in Game of Thrones, right? Where like, it's effectively, it's a hostage situation. That is there to kind of maintain a peace. But there are situations where a ward simply means like a highborn child who's not first in line for anything necessarily, or like the younger children get sent to ward mostly as like, it's like educational. Like she's being trained to be a lady of the court by Rhaenys at Driftmark. They don't really make it clear if that was like a strategy thing or if it's simply just like them trying to continue supporting the family.
I thought it was relatively clear in the scene where Daemon and Rhaenyra meet for the first time this episode, which is that they imply that, hey, Rhaenys is still a little bit mad because she thinks that Rhaenyra killed Laenor.
Right.
And so they, you know, the like sending Baela to ward with Rhaenys was kind of a way to kind of keep tensions in check. My understanding of it.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. Yeah.
Okay, so any other thoughts on this opening scene with Vaemond? I think it does a great job of kind of setting up the conflict of the episode.
Yeah, and I think especially when he says, like his sort of final rebuttal to Rhaenys is that, like, he knows that Viserys would not take his side. Everyone by now has presumably found out about the event of episode 7, where Alicent had this big outburst and Viserys kind of was like, once and for all, nobody ever talk about this again. Vaemond is very aware that Alicent would probably take his side and says that the queen sits the throne these days. And that is why he feels like he has a good enough chance to go and make his case, because he's very confident that Alicent would be on his side.
Indeed. We see Dragonstone in its full glory again. All the Dragonstone establishing shots have been pretty awesome this season. And there is an incredible shot of Daemon kind of descending into a dragon lair. And it was mind-blowing how good this is. I'll just describe the shot briefly for those who are only listening, but basically, like, you see, you're looking down or up above from the ground, and you see these massive rocks that have like tiny space in between them with like a tiny beam of light. And then you see a man in that space, and it's Daemon, and he's going down to get three dragon eggs from Syrax, mm-hmm. One of the dragons. And it's just an incredible visual of like just this tiny dude like against the elements. It's incredible. It's an incredible shot.
Mm-hmm.
He goes down. He gets these three eggs from what exactly? It's like a pouch of some kind. Kim, can you help me with this?
It seems to be some sort of like covered over nest. Like they refer to them as a clutch of eggs. So it's mm-hmm. like I imagine this dragon like dug a little hole like a dog, laid some eggs, and then put some stuff over it to like keep them warm and happy. And then Daemon is effectively like harvesting the eggs. It's almost like a really weird version of like getting the eggs from your chicken coop, but like your chicken coop is a massive mountain and you have to go like do some dangerous rock climbing in order to get your eggs.
Well, it seemed like when he put his pickaxe into mm-hmm. the clutch or whatever, there was like some kind of organic material. So it was, It was interesting. It was not like whatever. We learn a little bit more about how dragons give birth to eggs or lay eggs, basically.
Yeah.
And the dragon keepers say that Baela sent a message and it warns Daemon about Vaemond heading for King's Landing. You actually have a text of the message here in the show notes, Kim. How did you get that? Did you transcribe that?
I took a screenshot.
Wow.
And then just like, you know, I had to take multiple screenshots because like different parts of the letter are exposed at different times in the shot. But yes, I got the full text.
Which is, quote, "Father, I write with news of Uncle Vaemond, who this moment sails for King's Landing. He plans to appeal to his grace, the king, on matters of succession, rights, and the sanctity of blood. He wishes for the Driftwood throne to pass to him. That is his by rights, and that he is the only unattainted choice. End quote.
Yeah, I had to look up that word because I was like, I'm not sure if I'm transcribing this right, but it's a word. It basically means like unspoiled or like uncompromised.
Yeah. I love that that was all written down. Like some person, some artist had to like sit down and like write that message for it to be shown in probably 2 seconds of the show that then Kim Renfro screenshotted and then it makes its way onto a Cast of Kings podcast. And hopefully here, if you're listening to this artist out there who wrote that down, you experience vindication that your work was appreciated.
Yes. Really cool handwriting, by the way. Whoever did that. It was very neat.
Rhaenyra comes into the throne room at Dragonstone, and we meet Jace practicing High Valyrian in front of the map table with a maester. Obviously, Jace and Luke are both significantly older than we saw them last episode. You had an Easter egg about the maester in this scene, right?
Yeah, so this maester comes right from the books. He's named in Fire and Blood, Maester Gerardus, and it's spelled Gerardys in the books. But I'm almost positive this is a reference to George R. Martin's agent and one of the executive producers on House of the Dragon, Vince Gerardus. Vince spells his last name Gerardys, but it's like George just gave it the little Westerosi spin, switched that I to a Y, and then gave his agent and collaborator a nice little cameo in the story here.
Yeah. Over the course of the episode, we find out that, again, Rhaenyra has had 2 children since last episode. Mm-hmm. So she now has 4 children total, right?
With five
living children with one on
a
the way.
A sixth on the way.
Yeah. Okay, so her children are Luke, Jace,
Joffrey,
Aegon, to make things more confusing.
Aegon
the third. And then who's the fifth one?
Viserys, the second.
Viserys, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we meet some of those kids in this scene as well.
Yeah.
And she's pregnant again. This would be her third baby with Daemon.
Yes.
In this episode.
Yeah. So she has 3 with Harwin Strong, but under the guise of them being Laenor's children. And now she is on her way to having 3 children with Daemon, who are true born children, conceived under marriage and all that jazz.
Yeah. Daemon tells her about the unfortunate news, and they decide they need to head off to King's Landing. Any further thoughts on this sequence before we move on, Kim?
I thought it was a good... There was this like little exchange where Jace is like frustrated that he's not picking up on High Valyrian fast enough. And Rhaenyra kind of says like, well, she basically tells him like, well, you have time. Like you don't, all this pressure that you're putting on yourself to live up to your ancestors. He's presumably not going to be king until Rhaenyra is dead. And she kind of says like, that's a long way off. And so I think it does a good job of sort of setting the stage of like this whole bastard accusation conversation coming up again. It sort of reminds you that like none of this should be very urgent. Like even if Viserys dies tomorrow, which as we see later in the episode he does, Rhaenyra is the one who's next in line for the throne, and she is certainly the true blood child of Viserys. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought it was like a neat way of kind of like alluding to the fact that like there's an urgency placed upon this conversation that Rhaenyra isn't necessarily feeling, because she just is under the assumption that she is going to quickly ascend the throne and that presumably for a couple more decades be able to continue teaching Jace how to follow in her footsteps.
Indeed. I'm sure it's going to be smooth sailing for Rhaenyra from this point forward. So. We're going to take a quick break and thank a sponsor. We'll be right back and see what's going on at King's Landing in this episode of House of the Dragon. We cut to Alicent. She is in the small council room. She's apparently running this whole thing at this point in time. Quite the step up from when we first met Alicent Hightower, who, you know, was we had asked, like, why is she even in the room at this point? To now she's basically running the place. Mm-hmm. She's sitting in Viserys' seat. He's not even there anymore. And they're kind of going over the business of what's happening in King's Landing and all the land and kind of dealing with the economics of it. You clocked all the people sitting at the table, right, Kim?
Yeah. So we now have, obviously, Otto Hightower is Hand of the King again in his proper seat. We have Grand Maester Orwell, who is the maester who replaced Grand Maester Melos. He's the one who's been presumably keeping Viserys alive for way longer than another maester might have been able to keep him. We have Lord Lyman Beesbury, who's the Master of Coin. That's played by the same actor. Forgive me, I'm blanking on his name right now. It's from Fleabag. He plays the dad in Fleabag. That's why I keep, every time I see him talk, I'm like, oh, there goes Lord Beesbury again. We have Tyland Lannister, who we met in the big stag hunt episode earlier this season.
Bill Patterson is the name of the actor, by the way.
Bill Patterson. Thank you very much. Tyland Lannister is the Master of Ships at this point. Laris Strong is not at the table, but in Fire and Blood, he's still referred to at this point as the Master of Whisperers. And then Jasper Wilde has one line, I believe, in this scene. He's the Master of Laws. His nickname is Iron Rod, which has a little euphemistic connotation in Fire and Blood about his privates.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that they're going to let us know that in the show.
I hope they cover the origin of the term in House of the Dragon. there's a little conversation, but it's just very clear that Alicent's running the place. She leaves and then meets with Sir Eric Cargill, who she mistakes for his twin brother, who's also in the Kingsguard.
Whose name is Eric with an A instead of an E. Yeah.
It was a weird moment. I'm like, is this going to become important later that she made this mistake? You know, it's kind of a weird... I don't know if you had any thoughts on why they did that.
I almost thought it was just like a funny... It was like an almost meta, like, I can't keep track of these Eric and Erics. Like...
There are literally three Aegons referred to in this episode of House of the Dragon.
We have three Aegons, two Viserys.
Yeah, two Viserai, yep.
Two Viserai. We've got a Daemon and an Aemond and a Vaemond. A Rhaenys, Rhaenyra, Rhaena. Am I missing one? I'm like, no.
Laenor, Laena? Did you say that already?
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, we've got Laenor, Laena.
Yeah.
And the funniest thing about Eric and Eric is that they sound the same. Like, even when... he corrects her and she's like, oh yeah, sorry, Sir Eric. And I'm like, you can barely hear a switch of that that vowel. But yes, Eric and Eric are twins who are mentioned in Fire and Blood. So I think for some book readers, they were waiting to see if these Kingsguard twins were going to make an appearance in the show. And here they are.
Let's follow the Alicent storyline for just a little bit longer.
Yeah. Right?
So she can't figure out which Eric is guarding her, but whatever. One of the Erics tell her, hey, there's a delicate situation that's happened in the apartments. We're never told what it is. We just kind of like infer what it is from what happens next, which is she kind of meets with Diana, who is a terrified maid, kind of cowering in fear, who recounts the story of what happened. And essentially, I think what we can conclude is that Aegon, who is Alicent's oldest child. I'm saying it deliberately because I'm always just checking to make sure I'm saying Aegon and not Aemond.
Yes.
Aegon, her oldest child, the one who still has both of his eyes.
Yes.
He sexually assaulted Diana, essentially, is kind of what we're led to believe. And this scene I thought was absolutely incredible because of Olivia Cooke's performance. We talked on our Twitter space last night about how she reminded me of Gus Fring, honestly, in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, she's saying all the exact correct words you're supposed to say, and she's expressing sympathy, but like deep down, she's obviously feeling something very different. And everything she is saying is calculated to get a specific result from this situation, which is compliance from this person. Compliance and silence.
Yes.
And it's really chilling what Olivia Cooke is doing in this scene. And I thought brilliantly played. And sad to see that basically she has been weaponized by the patriarchy, right? Like this is
exactly.
Alicent could have easily herself been in that situation when she was younger. And now we see that she is now part of the oppressive system.
Yeah.
Or the oppressor's system, right?
Yeah.
She's
reinforcing the idea that the humanity of this serving girl does not matter in the context of the royal family and the implications for what would happen if like more people knew that this was going on. Yeah, I totally agree with you that Olivia Cooke does a phenomenal job in this scene of, right, like she's giving off like really threatening vibes at the same time that she's being, like you said, saying all the right things. You know, she embraces her. She like starts to kind of validate her, but it's almost more painful that like you see her say like, I believe you, you know, showing this empathy, and then turn around and say like, but what I worry about is that like, you were the one who was alone with him, and like, what might others believe were your intentions type of thing. So yeah, it like it that scene unfolds to the point that I'm like, it was also giving me Cersei vibes, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
In Game of Thrones, we saw Cersei have sort of similar conversations with Sansa or characters who like are clearly terrified. They want to be comforted by the queen, and yet what they wind up with is feeling like worse than ever. And so, yeah, by the time that the tea comes in, I was like, is she about to poison her? Like, it almost felt like it felt like a spider lulling someone into a false sense of security right before the blow lands.
I agree. That did feel really weird to me in the sense that I was like, oh, is this girl going to be killed? Like that was my whole question. Then Allison hands her money, and then I'm like, oh, like she probably wouldn't hand her money if she's going to kill her. And then later hands her the tea, and then like forces her to drink it in front of her. And then I'm like, okay, I think this will probably like, why would she do that if she was just going to kill her? It doesn't make sense to me. So I don't think she killed her. But yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think she did either, but I am waiting to see that serving girl. I'm waiting for Diana to pop up again in a future scene, or else have some other allusion to the fact that she has remained missing, right? Because we don't see her again after that scene in this episode.
Mm. Yes. She's referred to,
right?
Because, you know, I think it's Helena that says, like,
she was supposed to dress the children.
She was supposed to dress the children. And also, we should mention that at this point, Aegon, Allison's oldest child, even though Rhaenyra also has an Aegon, Aegon, tall, you know, blonde child who is Allison's oldest, has married Helena, also Allison's child,
yes,
who is blonde.
Yes.
So they are husband and wife, and I guess the Targaryens are cool with the incest stuff going on at this point.
Right. It's like the Hightowers.
The Hightowers have accepted
it. Do not seem to have given any objection to the Targaryen tradition of brother and sister marrying. If it helps from now on, this is something that is actually noted in Fire and Blood. Now that there are the two Aegons, they are referred to as Aegon the Elder and Aegon the Younger.
Mm-hmm.
So if we want to just say Aegon the Elder anytime that we're referring to Viserys and Allison's child, versus Aegon the Younger is Daemon and Rhaenyra's baby.
What was also, I'll just say, what was incredibly confusing to me, Kim, too, was obviously Aemon is Aegon's younger brother. In this episode, he's played by an actor that, in my opinion, looks way older and is, in fact, taller than Aegon. However, I did since get some emails and tweets basically saying the actor in real life is older. The Aegon actor in real life is older than the Aemon actor. And also, as you pointed out to me, Kim, in the space last night, it's not atypical for like a younger sibling to be taller than all the other siblings. So,
yeah.
But I will say I think also it matches what's depicted in the show matches the books, is my understanding too, in terms of their description of these characters. But as a show watcher, it was incredibly confusing. But I'll get over it.
Yeah. I think if there wasn't like a dramatic eye scar and patch, like it would have been way worse. I was like, okay, at least we like know there's like a very physical marker that says like this is Aemon at this point. But yeah, I agree. In terms of it matching the books, and I think that they do a pretty good job of showing you this over the course of this episode, it's kind of clear that Aemon, of all of the siblings of Alicent and Viserys' children, that like Aemon is the most capable, sort of strategic, I don't know, like princeling of them all, right? Like we see him defeat Kristen Cole in the training yard. And the last time, like Kristen was the only person to defeat Daemon in that tournament in the pilot episode. So like you're supposed to get the sense that Aemon has grown into a very like capable and threatening presence, whereas Aegon is kind of like
just
a wastrel.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, after this scene where Alicent Hightower buys off Diana's silence, and also, by the way, like a lot of people brought up Succession season two, I think
two.
It is. Succession yeah. season two with Shiv Roy. Like, there's an extremely similar scene in Succession season two where a female character in that show does a very similar thing as Alicent does in this show. It's equally chilling, I would argue.
Yeah.
And really well done. So great, great scene. Alicent then goes to Aegon's room and yells at him, and he seems to be so emotionally disconnected from everything right now. He doesn't even seem to understand why anyone could be bothered by it. So it's like pretty chilling and disturbing, his lack of moral compass whatsoever.
Yeah.
She slaps him and says, like, basically says, "You are no son of mine." She kind of disowns him. Go ahead.
I just think it's so interesting that we're seeing all this public conversation and debate around, like, the legitimacy of sons and all this stuff. And the fact that in private, Alicent is like, that the relationship is fraught to the point that Alicent is saying, like, "You are no son of mine." But then, of course, she's going to go in public and say, like, "This is my son and the only true born heir to," you know, like, there's a disconnect that I think is intentional of showing, like, what happens in the privacy of all of these families' interactions versus yes. what the public realm is understanding is the case.
Totally.
So she's doing a very good job of preserving his public reputation, while clearly in private, she's struggling with the way that he's behaving.
Right. Similarly, not that we have opposing viewpoints on this topic, Kim, but, you know, Rhaenyra obviously putting everything on the line, defending the legitimacy of her children.
Yeah.
When she knows that they are not legitimate.
Yeah.
And so I agree that that's something this show explores, is the difference between how these characters present themselves in public, what is necessary for the social order to continue, and what the true reality in private is.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting dichotomy. She also hugs Helaena, right, in this
yeah.
In this scene. And you do get a sense, like, she doesn't seem to have any real compassion for Diana, but she does have compassion for her daughter, Helaena, who needs to be married to Aegon, who is a terrible person.
Yeah.
I sensed real compassion there, but in her performance, but I'm curious what your reaction was.
Yeah, I think I would agree. I think that Alicent must understand that Helaena has basically been put in the same position that Alicent was put in when she was a teenager. It wasn't Helena's choice to be married to Aegon. It wasn't Aegon's choice to marry Helaena. That seems to just have been a strategic betrothal. And clearly Helaena, Helaena seems okay throughout this episode, but almost in like a, "I'm going to pretend," like, it's like she's like doing a little self-protection thing of like, "Oh, it's not too bad. But like sometimes when he's drunk, my husband brother assaults me," I think was like the implication.
Yeah,
you
terrible.
Know, it's really sad, but like you do get the sense that Alicent is trying to remain present for Helaena throughout all of this, as opposed to just like leaving her be. So yeah, I thought that hug was sincere.
Yeah. Then she goes to Viserys's chambers, where she confronts Rhaenyra and Daemon, and Rhaenyra and Daemon are very concerned with how she's treating the king. They seem to be kind of narcotizing the king, like keeping him under the influence of the Westerosi equivalent of morphine, which is milk of the poppy. And as a result, it allows them to kind of retain power and shape the small council and the kingdom to their will.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Any other thoughts on like Alicent's sequence of events here before we get to what happens with Rhaenyra during this equivalent time frame?
Just overall, I think that they did a really good job of showing how Alicent has like pivoted her strategy in the last 6 years. Like when we left off in episode 7, she had been kicked down a few notches, I think, because of her outburst and like the attack in front of all of the lords and ladies. And she was sort of having to be suppliant towards Viserys again. And then we jump here and she's much more like, her hair is like completely tightened up and braided to her head, as opposed to like episode 7. It was mostly down and loose the whole time. She has on all of these like ornamental Faith of the Seven bits. She's redecorated the castle to be more Faith of the Seven. So I just think like this entire introduction does a really good job, I think, of showing her new strategy of like, I'm going to be the pious, calm, cool, collected one who's like ruthlessly in control of as much as I can be at this stage.
Yeah. Daemon is really upset that she's taken down all the orgy tapestries and instead put up like religious posters basically everywhere, right? Is kind of what the equivalent is, pretty
yeah.
much.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that they're seeing a very clear visual representation of the shift in ruling power inside the castle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, during this time frame, Rhaenyra also meets Viserys for the first time after a while, introduces Viserys to her two new children, aka Joffrey and Viserys.
No, Aegon the third.
Aegon and Viserys.
And Viserys.
Joffrey
is
one of her children.
Yeah, Joffrey's okay. The youngest of the strong bastards. Dark-haired. So she has three dark-haired boys that she had with Harwin Strong who are purported to be Laenor's children. And then her two children with Daemon are very clearly blonde and Targaryen. So Aegon the third is slightly older. Yes. And yes. Viserys the second is like a baby or like a one-year-old.
Okay, sorry about that, Kim.
No, it's fine. I mean, look, you are not alone in like the naming confusion, so we can keep recapping it as much as possible.
It feels like a double whammy of both the names are all the same and also the show is doing very, very little to help you out, in my opinion. Like, there are so many things a show could do. Like, hey, here's the thing. The first episode of the show started with a voiceover from Rhaenyra, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, they could voiceover, like, in the time since last episode, these things have happened. I had a child, and then show the child on screen. You know, like, there's so many, I'm not saying that would have been, like, artful, but I don't know that, like, leaving a ton of the audience in a state of confusion is artful either, you know?
Yeah.
Here's what I will say. Despite how my many qualms with how the show is handling the time jumps, this episode, not only just doing the time jumps themselves, but again, how they're handling these transitions, this episode, I think, makes the strongest case for the approach that the show has taken, mm-hmm. which is to say, both A, casting Olivia Cooke, who was awesome last episode and is awesome this episode, right? But also seeing Viserys' body disintegrate before you as the show goes on, the full weight of that really does hit you this episode.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe if they had spread this out over two seasons, it wouldn't hit as hard. Whatever the case is, when Rhaenyra meets Viserys for the first time, I was in awe of what I was seeing just in terms of the visual effects. Like, when she touches his hand, like, you see his hands are like skinny around, like between the knuckles.
Yeah. Like, how lost so much weight. He's lost so much weight.
I'm like, how did they do that? How did they do this in you know, TV shows and films? It's very easy to add prosthetics onto people. Much harder to like take away, be subtractive. And so I'm like, did they use a body double? Did they use visual effects? Was it someone else's hand? You know, like, how did they even do it? Because it looks completely real, and it's an amazing effect. Like, and it's so subtle too. Like, I think like, you watch it and you're just, like, most people probably just be like, oh, that's just a guy who's like lost some weight. But like, in reality, I'm like thinking to myself, like, how did they do? It's incredible how they did this, right? Like,
yeah,
it's so subtle and like woven into the episode.
Yeah.
It blew me away. It blew me away. I was like, this is amazing what they were able to accomplish.
Yeah. And so affecting, like, that idea that he's effectively in hospice, right? And like, we don't know that. We don't know what the fact that the audience isn't sure what state he's in. So we get to experience that as Daemon and Rhaenyra see it. And for all their faults, Daemon and Rhaenyra certainly love and care for Viserys. And you really, it's very impactful just how difficult it might be to watch someone you love living in that state of pain and like confusion at all times. And I understand why they are upset that it doesn't seem like he has any attendants around him or that like, anybody seems to be paying much attention to him. And that clearly concerns them and again sets them once again in opposition to Alicent and her father.
All right, we'll have more to talk about with Rhaenyra, Daemon, and their interactions with Viserys. But before we get to that, hey, Kim, let's do a quick plug for some of the stuff you're working on. If people love our dialogue here on A Cast of Kings, where can they find more of your work on the internet?
Yeah, so I write all about House of the Dragon over on insider.com. You can find my articles there, and I usually tweet most of them too. So you can find me on Twitter at Kim R. Renfro.
Yeah, and I want to point out that A Cast of Kings will be going dark for a lot of the next year after the show is over, but I am continuing to podcast about television over at the Decoding TV podcast. Currently, we're covering She-Hulk, Andor, and the Rings of Power, and there's going to be more stuff we cover in the future with some really exciting folks. I hope you will check it out at podcast.decodingtv.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more conversation about House of the Dragon Season 1, Episode 8. Rhaenyra has a couple of scenes of conversation with Viserys in this episode. One where she, you know, obviously introduces the children to him, but then later on when he's kind of sleeping, she goes to his chambers. Not very much security in King Viserys' chambers from what I can tell, although I guess, you know, I guess like they don't prevent the husband, the wife, or the daughter from seeing him.
Right. She's the heir. Yeah. As far as all the attendants would know. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she communicates to him the difficulty of the prophecy and the weight of the prophecy on her and how she feels like she has to live the prophecy out. And at that point in time, he barely even knows what's going on is kind of my sense. I think he clocks it, and then later on, obviously talking to who he thinks is Rhaenyra, answers her question of like whether or not he really believes in the prophecy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm curious like what you thought of at least this one scene with Rhaenyra and Viserys where she kind of says how difficult it is to be Rhaenyra, you know?
Yeah.
I thought it was a pretty solid performance. And
yeah,
I'm curious if you have any thoughts on it.
I've been loving Emma Darcy's interpretation of Rhaenyra. I really liked Millie Alcock as well, obviously, but I think that Emma Darcy brings a really good gravity to many of Rhaenyra's lines. And the way that she seems to kind of like vacillate, Rhaenyra seems to sort of vacillate between sadness and like a little bit of anger, and then just like that overwhelm, like when she finally kind of like breaks down and sobs and says like, by naming me heir you divided the realm. Like, she seems very aware of the fact that it's only getting harder for her to defend her children and defend herself as the rightful heir to the Iron Throne. And it's one of those, I think that this scene did a really good job of also laying the emotional groundwork for the later throne room scene, because in that initial conversation in the dark and rainy room, you don't get the impression that Viserys is very conscious or like understands what Rhaenyra is saying, but she says like, please, what does she say? If you wish me to bear it, then defend me and my children. And you know, he can't respond. And so you aren't sure if he's going to be able to do anything. And I think that makes the impact of those doors opening later in the throne room even more poignant, because it's like, oh, he heard and like was able to get himself out of bed and really say what he wants for a change and make this final stand as a king. I think potentially in response to Rhaenyra's plea in this moment.
Because obviously he can settle it very easily and just back Rhaenyra up and everything's fine.
Right? Yeah.
So, okay. A couple of brief scenes before we get to the throne room scene with the big confrontation. We do see a scene in the courtyard where Luke and Jace go and they kind of see Aemond fighting for the first time. We see Aemond's a badass. We see Sir Criston Cole, and again, I expressed this to you last night on the space, but watching this episode of the show is almost like watching The Twilight Zone or like a Black Mirror episode or something, where literally King Viserys is like almost actively decomposing, and literally no one else or none of the other characters have aged. Obviously, the kids have changed actors, but like Rhaenyra looks the same, Sir Criston Cole looks the same, Rhaenys looks the same. Mm-hmm. And as you communicated, you know, in our space last night, you did the math, Kim, of how long, how many years have elapsed since the very first episode of House of the Dragon?
By
how many years
math,
have elapsed?
It's been 21 years since that pilot episode in Westeros. And yeah, Christian Cole does not look like a man in his late 30s, early 40s to me right now.
It is bizarre. Like, I am... I'm literally at a loss for words. As to why they chose to handle it in this way. Like, why they chose to age some people so heavily and then other people seemingly not at all. Like, sprinkle some freaking gray in his hair. Have him lose some hair. Like,
especially because they did it with Lionel Strong.
Yeah, Lionel
right?
Strong. He went bald before he died. And it's like... You know, yes, okay, maybe Sir Christian Cole is just like mega hot and he's one of those people that like looks good his entire life, but like mm-hmm. you got to change it up a little bit, show, okay? Yeah. You got to change it up a little bit.
It's funny because I've referenced my preseason like junket interviews a couple of times, but like all the cast preseason, I hadn't seen any of the episodes yet, so I was mostly talking to the actors about like the general stuff that I knew. And I knew that there were going to be these time jumps, right? And I was like looking at them, kind of trying to clock how old all the characters were supposed to be. So I asked each set of actors, like, can you tell me how old your character is at the start of the show? And then like whatever the time jump is. And most of them were pretty cagey about the time jump reference. They would only tell me like how old they are at the start of the show. But
because
Fabian...
no one wanted to tell you the show jumps 21 years between the first episode and the end.
Honestly.
But yeah.
And Fabian Frankel and Matt Smith, who play Kristen and Damon, were paired together. And when I asked them, they both, like, in unison were like, I couldn't tell you. Like, they had no idea how old they were supposed to be. They were ask Ryan Condal and Miguel Sapochnik. And when I did, and then Fabian Frankel and Matt Smith were also joking, like, I don't know, really. Like, I think we're just kind of ageless. And I was like, oh, haha, like, funny. And then, like, by now I'm like, oh, you were serious. Like,
yeah, they were serious.
You do not age. like throughout these episodes,
it is so freaking weird, Kim. Like the approach that they took is just so weird. Like I understand if you want to elapse tons of time and like no one ages, that's
right.
Fine. You know, like another example would be like Better Call Saul. Like, okay, all those people in Better Call Saul are theoretically younger than they were in Breaking Bad, but in fact, in real life, they're like older and like in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. But they're all aging at the same freaking rate. Like, it just doesn't make sense to have some people age way faster than others. You have Damon talking to Viserys. They looked the same age when the show began. They looked the same age. And then Viserys looks like he's dead in this episode, and Damon looks exactly the same age as with the first episode. It's just like, what the, like, thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
I hear you.
But it's also just like, that's a thing that is helpful for the viewer to understand what is going on in time, too. And the show is already, like, really confusing with all the time jumps and who's who and how many children Rhaenyra's had. And it's like, just throw us a freaking bone, people, you know?
Yeah.
Like, give us something to help us orient ourselves. Okay, sorry.
They are, and I've mentioned this before in pods, but I feel like this is a creative team who's very aware of the content machine that exists around mm-hmm. the show. And I think that this is like one of those times where they just relied on like, you'll be able to look it up after the episode airs exactly how old all these people are supposed to be or whatever. I think in the behind the scenes,
it's like, hey, should we gray up Kristen Cole's hair? And they're like, no. People are going to read Kim Renfro's Insider pieces. They're going to know exactly when this is taking place.
They're going to know that Fabian Frankel said that he was ageless in an interview 2 months mm-hmm. ago.
I have to say that freaking sucks as a form of TV storytelling. I'm just putting that out there. And it'd be one thing if it was like they're making some kind of point about how some characters donate, but it's like Sir Christian Cole, really? Like if it's like, oh, the Targaryens age slower or something like that, but it's like, okay, anyway.
I think, and again, not to continue harping on this, and I'm not defending it, I do think that it is clunky. It just seems like they were very focused on aging the children a certain amount of time, and they just like
Literally, that's where all their focus
went.
That's
it. Their focus was on taking multiple generations of children characters into adulthood and leaving... Zelda just stepped on my keyboard. Mm-hmm. That's very rude of you. You're supposed to be a third co-host, and now you're just messing everything up, Zelda. That's my cat, for anyone who's not watching this on YouTube. But... Yeah, they seemed hyper-focused on communicating the children's growth, and it seems like they let the adult evolution fall by the wayside.
Right.
Ryan Condal said in the After the Episode that this 6-year jump was intended to bring most of Rhaenyra and Allison's children into the 17 to 21-year-old range, which is a young adult in all societies, basically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, apparently that's where 100% of the focus went.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, thank you for listening to my rant on that. And you know, what would a Cast of Kings be without a good David Chen rant is the question.
Nothing at all.
Nothing at all.
Nothing at all.
Nothing. Wouldn't exist. Okay. There's a scene with Rhaena and Rhaenyra, basically. Is that right?
Yeah, you nailed it.
Okay, yes. In the Godswood, okay. Rhaenys, King Viserys' cousin, the woman, the queen that never was.
Yes.
Lord Corlys' wife, right? Rhaenyra comes and is basically like, hey, Rhaenys, can you back me up? BT dubs, I'm willing to betroth my children to yours. We can further strengthen our alliance if you do that. Rhaenys is, and also BT dubs, part two, didn't kill your son, even though you think I did. What do you say? And Rhaenys is non-committal in a really smart way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Also, Rhaenyra brings Rhaenys' daughter Rhaena to kind of soften
Rhaenys's
the ground a little bit.
Granddaughter. Daughter. Yes.
Yes, granddaughter.
Yeah. Rhaena is the oldest daughter of Laena and Daemon. And Laena was Rhaenys' daughter.
Right.
So Baela and Rhaena are Rhaenys' granddaughters.
Right. So Baela, they're Daemon's children, basically.
Yes.
And one of Daemon's children went off to be warded at Driftmark, and the other one stayed with Rhaenyra and Daemon. She brought her to kind of be like, hey, it's a kid you haven't seen in a while. Like, be happy for me, you know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, just an interesting prelude, a nice setup for Rhaenys and what would heading into the final episode, which also like speaking of Succession, strong Jerry vibes coming out of Rhaenys, I would say.
Good,
you know,
call.
Where she's saying let's I'll play the field depending on what happens.
Yeah, keeps her cards close to the chest, but exactly. Is still being very strategic. Yeah, I love the parallel between this marriage offer and the one that Rhaenyra made to Alicent a few episodes back, where she was like trying to sort of give the olive branch and be like, let's marry our children. Everything will be stronger from there on. That got rejected in the small council room in a very sort of like public embarrassing way for Rhaenyra. And the fact that this proposal comes in the Godswood, like in front of the Weirwood tree, a much quieter, like intimate thing. And I love that Rhaenys calls her out and says that's a generous offer or maybe a desperate one. And Rhaenyra was very quick to be like, what does it matter? Because I think that that was true back when she offered the same thing to Alicent. Even if she was only offering that because she felt kind of backed into a corner, doesn't make it a bad offer, honestly. By marrying Baela and Rhaena to Jason Luke, Rhaenyra is effectively kind of solving the problem that Vaemond has of saying, like, my blood needs to inherit this castle or whatever. Rhaenyra is basically saying, like, yeah, great, your blood can. Baela and Rhaena are definitely Laena's children. Nobody has ever contested that. And by putting them in kind of like co-power with Jason Luke, it does kind of placate the Valyrian issue of, like, you know, we don't have any blood. Well, now their children will certainly have Valyrian blood and continue that down in the line of Driftmark, as opposed to snuffing it out entirely, which I get is a valid concern of Vaemond's. Yeah.
Well, then it's the throne room. The big confrontation. We get like a lot of different angles of the throne room, too. Like an above angle, we get to see it's in full glory, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And they all fill in and they have this kind of trial, I guess. I don't know what the technical legal term is for it in Westeros, but
they kept calling it petitions.
Yeah.
Right?
Petition.
Yeah. Petitions for succession matters or whatever. Yeah.
Otto Hightower sits on the throne in Viserys' stead. And here's Vaemon's case. And Vaemon explains his case, which is that he wants somebody from his house to sit on the Driftmark throne.
Mm-hmm.
And the implication is that that Rhaenyra's children are not of Corlys's line of people. And Rhaenyra is really unhappy with this implication, and she's about to object to it when all of a sudden the throne room doors swing open, and in a kind of parallel scene from episode 5 of the show, instead of Alicent Hightower interrupting Viserys, taking care of something with a line of succession, it's the other way around. King Viserys interrupting the Hightowers, trying to impose their will on the people. And Viserys comes in, he's got a gold mask to cover the part of his face that's, you know, he's missing an eye, and he slowly walks to the throne room, and it's to the throne. It's a really effective scene. It takes place almost in real time, as far as I can tell, where you really feel the weight of how much time and effort it takes him to get to the throne. And there's a few sort of moving parts of this, right? You see everyone's reaction to him. Alicent obviously is really disappointed. She's like, oh, Viserys messing with my plans yet again, you know, mm-hmm. which is pretty fun to see. And then, of course, at the end, Daemon comes and helps him up.
Yeah.
I was very moved by that because you do get a sense that, hey, Daemon's a different person now.
Yeah.
I do still wish that we had gotten more of their relationship in the intervening decades. You know, would have been nice to see, like you can imagine if that came at the end of season 2 of the show, like how much more it would mean to you than that. I feel like we've really rushed the Daemon Viserys relationship through this season. But mm-hmm. despite that concern, it's a really powerful moment because like Daemon has changed. You see how far he has come from the first episode. The change happened extremely quickly and rapidly over the course of very few episodes, but you do see they used to fight each other, they used to hate each other, and now at the end of Viserys' life, Daemon's still showing up for Viserys in a really powerful, meaningful way in front of everyone.
Yeah.
Anyway, any
and
thoughts?
And the fact that Viserys will only accept help.
Yes.
Like, he's too proud to take help from a Kingsguard, even though the Kingsguard are there just to protect him, but he has this pride that only Daemon can kind of get under when it comes to just showing him like a moment of support. The fact that Daemon is the one who picks up the crown, which I just this morning I was reading an Entertainment Weekly article. Apparently that was like a little mishap that happened while filming. The crown accidentally fell off of Paddy Considine's face and Matt Smith just picked it up. And then they decided to like keep that as the, and I was like, beautiful, beautiful improvisation of like the symbolism of Daemon clearly no longer being the type of person who is trying to take Viserys's crown, but instead is happy to give him a dignified final seat on the Iron Throne.
Yeah.
I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah. And that's how you know you're dealing with professional actors. They don't break character even when, you know, something like that happens. But
yeah.
Well, speaking of Viserys, he sits on the throne and he's basically says, per my email,
I must admit my confusion.
Yes. He's like, I don't understand why we're even here. The matter has been settled. Why are we even here? Of course, the reason why we're here is because the matter has been settled in a way that is unsatisfactory to Vaemond, who is in the courtroom and presenting the case.
Mm-hmm.
And Vaemond. So at that point, Viserys is like, all right, fine. The one person whose opinion I care about is Rhaenys. And at that point, Rhaenys sees where the tide is turning and where it's heading and where the wind is blowing. And she comes in and basically joins Rhaenyra's side, right?
Yeah.
She's like, yeah, actually, why are we here? And also, my children are marrying Rhaenyra's children and the matter is settled, you know? And at that point, Vaemond goes off and he continues to say a series of escalating things that as I'm watching, I'm like, this is going to be impossible for you to take back, sir. You know, like,
mm-hmm.
And it's a really impressive performance, by the actor who plays Vaemond.
Yeah.
In the show.
Yeah. A lot of righteousness.
Will Johnson, I believe, is the name of the actor.
Yeah.
Who plays Raymond. And yeah, he and eventually like calls Rhaenyra a whore, which is just like, that you're done, man. You can't, like, you could have gotten out of this unscathed, you know?
Yeah.
But he had to do it. Now, whether or not it will make an impact, I think it clearly did make an impact.
Yeah.
His death, like coming out like that and then getting killed for it, getting struck down for it.
Big
obviously
example.
Obviously made an impact on Rhaenys and also probably Alicent Hightower, right?
Yeah.
And so maybe there's like, that was part of the calculation was like, I'd rather die speaking the truth than and having people know what I think about it than live in fear of yeah. speaking the truth, you know. But it's an incredible sequence, and then obviously the king says he's gonna take his tongue out, and then Daemon just cuts his head off, cuts off half of his head, and then it falls to the ground and you see his tongue is still in his head, and then it's like he can keep his tongue, and it's like, okay. Very cute.
I was like, how many times have you practiced cutting people's heads off so that their tongue is still intact?
Yes. He knows exactly the orbital angle. Plane on which to... Yeah, to do it. But it's a shocking moment. It's classic Game of Thrones stuff.
I literally gasped.
It's a great sequence.
I literally was like... because I, like, in the books, I put the quote here. In Fire and Blood, the way that this unfolds is much more just like general. It just sort of says like Vaemond was protesting, once again said that Rhaenyra's sons were bastards. And then it says, quote, the princess was not slow in answering this charge. She dispatched Prince Daemon to seize Sir Vaemond, had his head removed, and fed his carcass to her dragon Syrax. So the fact that they changed this so that it happens so quickly, it's not something that like Rhaenyra or Viserys actually order. It's just something that Daemon sort of does impulsively to defend his stepsons and his wife in the room, as well as Viserys. Like, Vaemond is being outright, like, he's telling Viserys that he broke laws and all of this stuff by naming Rhaenyra heir. He was bang out of order, as
yeah,
I wrote
yeah.
in my notes.
It was really... I was just like, wow. Every 3 seconds, Vaemond was saying something. I was like, oh my gosh, he said that? And then Daemon kills... my favorite part was when Daemon kills him, and then all the Kingsguard are like, hey, you can't kill someone. And he's like, okay, I take it back. Here's a sword.
Worry.
You know? Don't worry, I'm not going to kill anyone else. You know, like, and it's like, okay. Maybe they should check people's weapons at the door for these petitions, you know?
Yeah, they need a TSA in a... In King's Landing.
Courtroom metal detector.
Courtroom
basically.
Metal detector. Yeah. I loved Aemond's reaction to this too. Like, they kind of cut to Aemond, one eye, given this smirk, and he's sort of like, ooh, hello, Uncle Daemon. We might have a similar inclination.
Yeah, like your style, dude. And yeah, we have seen Daemon be a lot more chill in this later era of his life, but... he still has a little bit of that fight in him, so, and the impulsiveness in him. So
yeah.
I think the only thing that kind of saved Daemon in this scene was the king expressing his desire to remove that guy's tongue. Like, if the king hadn't said that, then Daemon probably would have been more out of order. But instead, the argument could be made that he was enacting the will of the king, you know?
Yeah.
So,
albeit just more rapidly than normal order.
Yeah. Well, and more intensely, because he said, I want the guy's tongue. He didn't want his
True.
Top half of his head, so.
No.
So then we get this whole sequence with Vaemond's body being, I guess, embalmed or whatever by the Silent Sisters.
Yeah.
And Master Orwell says, it is ill luck to look upon death. And Rhaeny says, the stranger has visited me more times than I can count. Interesting way to refer to death as the stranger. Has that happened in Game of Thrones before?
Yeah. So the stranger is one of the gods of the Faith of the Seven. Mm. So there's like the mother, the father, etc. The stranger is supposed to be the sort of like spooky, death-focused one. Like, he's the god that not very many people like to worship or talk about very often within mm-hmm. Westeros, in the same way that they say, like, the mother will grace my cause. Or I think Alicent referred earlier to, like, the father is just and... approves of my methods here, type of thing.
Yeah. Beautiful scene, but I was just like, I wonder what, like, why they put that here. I guess just to kind of show that his death has an impact on Rhaenys, you know?
I have a theory, but I don't think I can talk about it in detail until next week.
Okay.
But if you were wondering if there's a reason why they had that scene in there, I think I have an answer.
Okay. Maybe, you know, Kim, here's my request. Send it to me in an email.
Okay.
And then on next week's episode, we'll open the email. We'll see if you're right. How about that?
Okay. Fun.
Well, there's one more big confrontation in this episode, but we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment to talk about the final scenes in House of the Dragon Season 1, Episode 8. All right, Kim, let's talk about the final sequence in this episode, which takes place with the whole family. King Viserys is like, hey, the whole family's here. I want to dine with them. Because we know, and this has been well set up in previous episodes, Viserys loves the idea of family. You know, he's done a poor job of setting them up for success and nurturing love between them, and he seems to be completely oblivious to the major enmity and sort of ill will that's going on between them, you know? But but he still loves the idea, and so he comes into the dining room, the dining hall, and there's a series of awkward interactions ensue. You can tell the kids like really still hate each other. Aegon in particular seems to be needling Jace all night. You know, they're supposed to be celebrating their betrothal, but he's like, you know, questioning his masculinity and his manhood the whole night, pretty much. But there is a big speech that Viserys makes at the dinner scene, and he takes off his mask. He's like, I want you to see me as I am. And I think that, you know, there's several reasons for that, but I think he wants them to understand how high stakes it is that all these people get along. Because if they are torn apart, then the House of Targaryen will not stand, the kingdom will suffer, and they need to get along because he's not going to be around for much longer, I think is kind of what he's trying to communicate. When he takes off the mask, it's very similar to like Two-Face in The Dark Knight. Like you see like the eye socket and you see, you know, like his musculature underneath his skin.
Gnarly.
In real life, someone like that would have gone septic long ago, but you know, we're living with Westeros rules. And so he is still able to talk. It's horrifying. It's an incredible effect. It's horrifying.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I'm curious if you have any thoughts on Viserys' speech and this whole sequence, Kim.
Yeah, I mean, the whole dinner I thought was fascinating because everybody seems to kind of vacillate between sincerity and faux politeness for the sake of Viserys and like trying to clock like, okay, are they doing this to put on a little bit of a show for Viserys or is there actually some genuine healing happening here at this dinner table? It's just so much tragedy wrapped up in one single family dinner, which I think is very, very Thrones of them to sort of just let this scene linger and go through all the phases of like awkwardness, a little bit of sincerity and pleading from Viserys, then into like, let's have some music. And there's, oh, everybody's dancing and nice. And like, there's sort of that like slow-mo zoom in of like Viserys actually getting to see his whole family together. And I was like, that's nice, even if it's not going to last. It's nice for this 30 seconds.
To make things extremely real for a moment, it reminded me in some ways of my many, many years ago, my grandmother passed away. And when my mom heard that she was like in really bad shape, she took both me and my brother to California to see my grandmother one last time. And we went to the hospital and saw my grandmother, and she was in, you know, not a great state. She barely, but she knew we were there. And then she passed literally like days after we arrived.
Yeah.
And I do get the sense that she was kind of like, and people were saying to me at the time, like she was like holding on until like she saw my mom and her grandchildren like one more time.
Yeah.
In the hospital. And I do think there's this idea of like, and it reminded me of this scene where like Viserys, I think, was like holding, you know, he was clearly on his way out, but he was holding on until he was able to like experience this whole thing with his family. And then he kind of like let go like that. He felt he had done what he had to do, seen what he had to see, and he like let go.
Yeah.
It's it's always fascinated me, the idea that like people can kind of, that they have some will in terms of how they leave, you know, how they pass away.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah.
It's not just like a clock that like, you know, once it gets to zero, you're dead. It's like people have some say in the matter. And that's always fascinated me. So
yeah. Anyway. I had a similar situation last summer. My aunt was in hospice and a lot of the family flew from like different parts of the country to see her. And then they had been there for like 5 days and they finally had to like, two of my other aunts had to leave that night. And so like, we were kind of like all together this one last time. And then people like had to fly home and stuff. And my aunt passed away later that night. And it was like, somehow she had known that like, okay, all the family isn't here anymore, or like we had all that time together and now it's time to go. So yeah, I totally know what you're talking about in terms of that. Like, there does sometimes seem to be a added level of like awareness, I think, of the final moments of life sometimes among mm-hmm. family. It's very touching. And this episode was really emotional in many different moments, from the throne scene to this dinner scene to then his final conversation with Alicent.
I mean, let's get back to the scene. I know that was, mm-hmm. you know, let's, I think that, some of the storytelling in this episode is pretty rough, specifically around Rhaenyra and Alicent. Mm-hmm. I think we are meant to believe that like Rhaenyra and Alicent are like starting to patch things up and that Alicent is starting to accept things. And they have this very meaningful conversation when King Viserys is not looking. You know, and Alicent's like, hey, it would be great. I'm so sorry that you're leaving. It would be great if you hung out a little more. I think we're supposed to interpret that as actually genuine. And then, of course, it's all completely undone by this mm-hmm. wacky sitcom-like misunderstanding at the end when Alicent thinks that Viserys is talking about a different Aegon.
Right? Yeah.
And that's rough, in my opinion. Like, it's rough that it's because of a misunderstanding. And I think that I don't know that the show really gives us enough for us to feel like Rhaenyra and Alicent would have patched things up. You know, I think it's very clearly meant to be a rug pull, like, oh, Rhaenyra and Alicent are getting along again. And maybe I could see Alicent grudgingly accepting the new order. But yeah, like, we see a lot of like warmth towards Rhaenyra from Alicent that I'm like, that seems kind of random where that's coming from. Oh, it's so that the showrunners can like take it away from us at the very end of the show.
Yeah,
that's my assessment. But you did a great job of pointing out during our Twitter space last night that what the show has done a good job of setting up is that there is a lot of bitterness from Alicent. And so like her turning, like her hearing Viserys's prophecy misapplied and then presumably turning against Rhaenyra afterwards, is well set up. Like that is not, right. You know, that is well set up. There's tons of material the show's given us for that.
Right.
It's this kind of like, why are they getting along? Why is like Alicent so nice all of a sudden? That part's, I think, is a little bit poorly set up. What do you think, Kim?
I think another scene I would point to in this episode is the second small council room scene where it's just Alicent, Vaemond, and Otto talking, like mm-hmm. before the petitions happen.
Mm, yeah.
And Alicent does express in private in that situation, she calls it like uneasiness. Like you kind of get the sense that she is starting, that there's a tiny bit of doubt in whether or not she's doing the correct thing by deciding to back Vaemond entirely and like once again reignite this whole conversation about the Valyrian children, yeah, aka the Strongs. So yeah, by the time we got to this dinner scene, like, I wrote in my notes at the very end when, like, Alicent says Rhaenyra she wants to say, I just wrote, weird vibe. Does she mean it? Because I wasn't sure. I was like, right, I don't know if this is her strategizing or if she's genuinely coming around. Because
Go ahead. Finish what you're saying. I apologize. Didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, I just, yeah, I wasn't sure whether or not to trust it. And then the scene with Viserys, I was like, okay, once again, we have Alicent in private, and she does seem to be acting pretty tenderly and caring toward Viserys. And it felt to me like it was like the episode took us through a little bit of a roller coaster of like, Alicent has been on this mission and been very intent and confident in her feeling that what Rhaenyra is doing is not okay. And yet she's just maybe starting to doubt whether or not her insisting on that is the right thing to do. Viserys makes a plea for everybody to please just get along. You're on my computer again. Sorry. But I think, yeah, it's like, so by Viserys having this, you know, as you said, sitcom-esque miscommunication with her about Aegon, it's almost like that was the, I think that they want us to believe that that was the only piece of evidence Alicent needed to believe that everything she's been doing for the last 20 years was in fact correct. And that any doubts that she had about like whether or not it was okay or whether the ends justify the means in this situation, this is now like, this is going to be her North Star of like, oh yes, I was correct this whole time. It was just those silly Targaryens who had me doubting myself, but like now I'm back on the cause of, you know? But I agree, yeah. I agree that I was watching that miscommunication unfold with Alicent and Viserys and being like, oh my God, we're really gonna like mostly hinge like this incredible
whatever conflict, comes next.
Whatever comes next, we're gonna mostly hinge this future conflict on a simple little misunderstanding. Naming. And it's like, and it also presupposes that Viserys has literally never talked about this with anyone but Rhaenyra, and that Rhaenyra wouldn't ever possibly communicate that to Alicent either. Like, it's a lot of secret keeping that in a world where secrets seem very hard to keep, I'm like, really? We're now going to have two people who independently think that they are like the sole protectors of this prophecy, fact, whatever. Yeah, it was a little frustrating. You can do that once in a show. We already got it with the Sir Criston thing, right? Yeah. We talked about this yesterday in like the Twitter spaces too. And I was like, two is a little much for a lot of pivotal plot points to hinge on a simple one word miscommunication.
Well, hopefully it'll teach them to not name all their kids the same in the future, you know? But yeah, I think that that's the rough part, is the idea of like, here's the thing that really threw me off, is Alicent's emotions following the throne room scene are not recognizable to me as somebody who would be in Alicent's situation.
Right? Yeah.
If I was Alicent and I had this whole plan to like finally expose this person who I've hated for like 10 years and like figure out a way to like restore justice to its place, and then my old husband, who I didn't really like that much, came in at the last minute and stopped it, my next reaction would not be, oh, maybe he is right, I should try to patch things up with Rhaenyra. I'd be freaking furious. You know, that's me. And maybe Alicent is not as, I don't know, emotional as me, but it really does seem like she is based on what we've seen in earlier episodes.
Yeah.
So then she's like, oh, okay. Like basically the Kim walking in and ruining her plan at the last second had no emotional impact on her, apparently. And then she's like, oh, I should patch things up with Rhaenyra. And then she's like starting to patch things up, and she's like really close to everything being okay. And then whoops, all of a sudden, misunderstanding. King says the wrong words, thinking he's talking to Rhaenyra instead of Alicent. It's rough. It's rough storytelling, but I think, again, credit to Kim Renfro, like the part of the storytelling that is good is that it's not too much of a stretch to believe that Alicent, you know, is going to have a conflict with Rhaenyra based on what's happened. Like,
yeah,
that stuff has been well set up and is fairly good storytelling thus far. And so I assume that Alicent and Rhaenyra will have conflicts moving forward, and that a lot of season one has been setting that stuff up. So despite them fumbling this entire plot line at the end zone, everything up until this point has been pretty good on that regard. And so I give them credit for that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, you know, you referred to the secrecy here. Jennifer from Madison, Wisconsin writes into castkings@gmail.com. Am I wrong to think that if only the late Viserys would have just told Queen Alicent about the true prophecy, this would have avoided a lot of trouble? Alicent seems so close to accepting her Rhaenyra and her rights to the throne once the king passes. I have so many feelings towards Alicent and the way she presumably is taking this ultra-classified information and running with it. Wouldn't she question how Viserys had been so adamant about Rhaenyra all the time, and then all of a sudden he wants Alicent's Aegon to rule? I'd be pissed if I were Alicent and my husband waited until the very last breath to tell me this very important important information. Where is this living trust slash where is the living trust slash will for the people in this world? Like, you know, advanced directives and such, I think is what Jennifer's referring to. It seems that they had a system for succession protocol. Wouldn't this be the case for the throne? This is infuriating and tragic, of course. Also, at this point in time in House of the Dragon, do they know about this prophecy or some tidbits of this looming winter? By the time Game of Thrones comes, it seems that everyone knows that winter is coming. It's just so much to remember. I really appreciate your podcast and the thorough analysis of what in the Helena is going on. So thanks for writing into acastofkings@gmail.com. And yeah, there is a question. And I love the title of Jennifer's email, which was classified documents. You know,
yeah,
she shouldn't have treated the classified documents in that way. So, okay. I mean, you had actually answered the question in our pre-show conversation, Kim, about whether or not people in Game of Thrones knew about the prophecy. And the answer is basically no, right?
Yeah, no. By the time we get to Game of Thrones, like, all traces of sort of magic and prophecy and dragon dreaming have fallen out of, like, common knowledge. And winter is coming are just House Stark's. Those have been House Stark's words for centuries. And it's supposed to be, like, a little bit of dramatic irony that people forgot that winter is coming doesn't just mean, oh, we're in the north and we're going to endure hard seasons. It means, like, that there is a threat called the White Walkers that are coming for Westeros.
Gotcha.
Same with, like, fire and blood are House Targaryen's words. And there's, like, a pretty neat sort of, like, book theory among A Song of Ice and Fire readers that fire and blood isn't just, like, two cool things that Targaryens love, but it's actually, like, the recipe for hatching dragons that we see Daenerys sacrifice Miri Mazdur in a fire, and that is what hatches the first dragons that have been seen in Westeros for a very long time. And it's like, it's almost like Dany, like, accidentally stumbled upon the recipe in House Targaryen's words.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I do just want to call out the final scene of the episode where King Viserys passes away. It's, other than the ridiculous misunderstanding, it's actually very well done. Like, you really see him, the acting, the deathbed acting is really impressive. He's, like, wheezing for most of the episode, and you really believe that he's in horrible pain and in terrible agony. And and then he passes away, and then the episode, I think, did a like, sometimes it cuts to black with no music. Usually,
yeah,
the credits is like they hit you with the Ramin Djawadi score. Like, sometimes when a major character death happens, no music. I think that was the case this episode.
Yeah,
it's all very effective. And then he reaches his hand up in towards the ceiling, and you don't know what he's reaching for. And then his final words are, "My love."
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's referring to Emma probably in that scene, right? What do you think?
I think probably if he's thinking back to, like, because, you know, his final words are speaking to who he thinks. I mean, he does think that he's talking to Rhaenyra. So maybe he's trying to say my love to Rhaenyra for one last time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's thinking about Emma, since, again, they've already established that his quest to honor this prophecy, or to, like, ensure this prophecy's continuance, led to Emma's painful death. So yeah, I think it could be interpreted in multiple ways, but either way, it's certainly supposed to be a very tragic, and, like, I think that it's just so, that's so Viserys' spirit, right? Like, he always cared very deeply about the people around him, but he made a lot of mistakes that caused a lot of harm along the way. And this is the final one. This is the final big goof. Whoopsies.
Oh, he made one last whoopsie daisy.
One last one.
Which, as somebody pointed out during our space last night, is very in character for King Viserys to go out causing a ton of chaos on his way out as well. I choose to believe it was Emma, because I think that does a good job of kind of tying up this character's arc over the course of the first 8 episodes of the show.
Like, yeah.
He started the show basically causing Emma's death in a really heartless and cruel way, and then has kind of spent the last 8 episodes agonizing over it.
Yeah.
And then for it to be kind of the last thing he's thinking about when he passes,
yeah,
feels like very poetic to me.
Right. The fact that he made the choice to allow Emma to be killed via medieval C-section as opposed to dying in childbirth as she was about to, simply because he was hoping that her baby would be the one to fulfill this prophecy for him. Yeah.
All right. We are running out of time here, Kim, but there's a couple of scenes that did happen that we didn't talk about. We saw Missaria again. And there was a servant that approached Missaria. But by the way, Missaria, another character who has not aged in 15 years or so.
Not at all. Looks the same.
At all. Looks exactly the same.
She has a house now. Good for her.
Yeah. And a servant approaches her. And I don't know if anyone else experienced this, but I was like, who is that? That is a servant from Allison's quarters named Tyla, correct?
Yes. We saw her. Last time she was featured rather prominently was in episode 6, when Alicent and Laris are having their little secret dinner that eventually leads to the Strongs being killed. Tyla walks in at one point with like something in her hand, like sheets or something. And both Alicent and Laris kind of go quiet and Alicent dismisses her and then they resume talking afterwards. So, and then earlier in this episode, she was also the one who brought the moon tea for Diana to drink. Mm. And so by letting us know that Tyla is apparently reporting to Missaria on the comings and goings of the castle, we can assume, I think pretty safely, that she has a nice little store of knowledge about Allison's comings and goings, and has been reporting those to Missaria. To what end? We don't know. We don't know what Missaria is trying to do with this information, what side she's on, but I think it's a notable...
Yeah, presumably it will come into play in the last two episodes or possibly next season.
Yeah.
We saw Helena chilling out with one of Rhaenyra's children in the episode. They're kind of doing a little fun dance. That was cool.
Yeah, Helena and Jace. Yeah. Cute.
And she kind of says another one of her cryptic prophecies. You hide the beast beneath the boards. That's what she said, right? Which is
Or like beware the beast beneath the boards. I might have transcribed that funkily. Yeah, I was like, okay, what's that one? And then the pig scene happened, or like, you know, a roasted pig is put.
They brought a pig out and they like focused on the pig. So maybe she's talking about the pig, maybe.
Because like, I was trying to think back to the way that they staged the scene where like the kids back in episode 6, like played that little prank on Aemon, and the pig kind of comes up from like beneath the dragon pit. And I was like, oh, was that just like a quickly resolved reference? If she was saying like, beware the beast beneath the boards. That pig coming out at this dinner scene kind of sets off a new chain of violence and antagonism between all the characters that had just sort of seemingly all been chummy. Or maybe it's something coming up that we will look back on that line and feel like we know more about. So yeah, basically Helena, it's interesting because Helena seemed like in the previous episode, she seemed so like kind of quiet and serious and a little bit of an oddball. I think by now in this jump, she seems much more like, la-di-da, I'm just like trying to live my best life as a princess. But it's funny that she still just like blurts out these little like little weird cryptic phrasings that no one else seems to be paying much attention to.
She'd be kind of like neurodivergent, I think, you know, in if she was in present day. It's kind of how I think she's coded in the show.
Yeah.
But... we got to wrap up, unfortunately.
I'm sorry, we can talk forever.
No. Well, I say that because there is one scene I wanted to mention, and we're not going to be able to talk about it in depth as I would like, but it's the scene where kind of Aemon makes a toast and is like, I love all these, you know, Rhaenyra's strong children. May they, you know, they're so strong, which is like, mwah, mwah, chef's kiss, delightful punnery, sir. Very nicely done. And then kind of Daemon steps in to kind of defend his kids, but there's this kind of moment between Aemon and Daemon where it's kind of like game recognized game. Like I think Daemon realizes like that's a younger version of him, basically, which, you know, and they also look very similar. Their names are basically anagrams of each other. You know, so it's like there's a lot of like parallels going on there. And it's a great scene. I wanted to call that out as well.
The fact that Matt Smith has in such a quick time been able to get us to understand that Daemon can threaten someone without words, right? He doesn't even have to draw a weapon or anything. He simply just like reassures Jace, like, go over in there in the corner, I got this, and turns around and just like stares down Aemon, and that's enough to like diffuse the situation. It's great.
Great scene. Okay. Gotta wrap things up there. But overall, great episode. Some issues with it, but King Viserys, the character, Paddy Considine's performance, it's a magic trick. It's amazing to see it happen on screen. There was a scene earlier we actually didn't refer to where, like, you see his withered body as well. Yeah. Like, you see his, it's like, wow, how did, it's incredible. Like, it, at no point am I questioning that I'm seeing what I'm supposed to be seeing, which is like Paddy Considine's body withering away, but it looks so convincing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's such subtle work too. It's not flashy, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm so impressed by it. Okay. Anyway, that's going to do it for us here today on Acast Kings. You can find more episodes of Zelda making another appearance on the YouTube show. You can find more episodes of this podcast at acastofkings.com. Email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter, TikTok, YouTube, at Acast of Kings. And also, we are not going to be recapping anything for now during the off season, but I do want to encourage you to check out the Decoding TV podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com, where we're going to be covering TV throughout the year with lots of cool different co-hosts. But yeah, podcast.decodingtv.com. Thank you so much for listening. She is Kim Renfro. I'm David Chen. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.